The sun is shining and the sap is flowing. It's maple syrup time in Iowa. This hour, we'll talk about making maple syrup. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall will be here to walk us through the maple syrup making process. Shortly after the sap starts to flow, the insects start to show up. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to bring us up to date on the spread of the emerald ash borer. Then ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will join the show. He, Mark, and Jesse will answer your questions about the plants and trees in your life. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. It's a beautiful day across the state of Iowa and a perfect day to talk about maple syrup production. A little later in the show, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here along with Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron to answer your questions. But first, Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall is here. Hello, Jesse.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we had already decided we were going to talk about maple syrup production, and then if my facts are correct, all of a sudden maple sap started flowing this week.
It is. You look at the weather the next 10 days, it is just going to open up, and it's going to be, if you capture the next 10 days, a great start to the season.
All right, and what are the conditions that get the sap flowing?
What we're looking for are warm days, so 45, 50 degrees, but then back down cold into the 20s at night, and that freezing and thawing action creates the sap rise that we need to harvest that maple sap.
All right. And of course, those conditions kind of come every February, sometimes in January. Is there usually a window, or do you just have to wait until the forecast changes and get moving?
Well, you know, we used to say, well, we tap on the 15th of February and you're going to get most of the season. And we looked at the weather forecast back on our family farm in upstate New York, and we said, you know what? The sap's going to run at the end of January, and we tapped and made hundreds of gallons of beautiful maple syrup in January, the earliest we've ever made. So we've changed our thinking. When you begin to see 3 to 4 days of perfect maple weather in January, we're now taking advantage of that, and we're making really good syrup earlier in the season now, and then everything else at the end of the season is kind of gravy on top of your season. So we've changed how we look at the weather, and we're much better at predicting those 3 to 4 day warm and cold night swings, and we're capturing it.
Now, you talked about the freezing nights being very important in bringing the sap up, but let's say you have a period of time where it's above normal and you have warm days and nights that are above freezing. Does that kind of ruin this magic spell?
It does. It can really set you back, and we can get away with 2 to 3 days of above average temperature. But then what's going to have to happen is for a period of 3 to 4 more days after that, it has to get really cold, down into the teens and really low 20s for that tree to recharge and for it to begin again. And if we don't get that, your season could be 3 days long and then it's over.
All right. And once it actually gets warm, the flavor changes, right?
It does. What'll happen, and that's a it's function of being warm, but it's also a function of day length. And we're racing against the day length clock. We can't really shut that off. And what'll happen is the buds will begin to swell and they will begin to get active, and it changes the chemistry of the sap. And it's called making buddy syrup. And you'll boil it down. It will almost be at the consistency of maple syrup, which is 66% sugar. A magical thing happens at about 64% sugar when the sap is buddy and the syrup becomes buddy, right about 64% sugar. So you've spent all this time boiling it down. It turns into just a horrible tasting. It's just a bad syrup. You don't want to be in the sugar house. It smells bad. No. It tastes bad. It's just bad.
All right. So, you know, I know over the years, a lot of people have planted a lot of sugar maple trees. Mm-hmm. And now I was at a farm store just the other day, and I saw that just on the shelf was all the equipment that I would need to start tapping my own trees and collecting sap. How old does a tree have to be before you can tap it?
Really, we don't so much look at age. We look at size. And what we're looking for on an average size tree to have one tap is 12 inches at diameter at breast height. So 4.5 feet above the ground, we're looking for a 12-inch tree.
Okay, so a fairly adult, mature tree we're talking about.
If you want to throw an age out there, let's say 40.
All right. And so a lot of those little trees that people have planted in front of their houses because they love that red color, it's going to be a while.
It's going to be a little while.
With the trees that people who actually produce maple syrup tap, when they, you know, actually have a grove, they've got the trees big enough, how much can one tree produce as far as sap goes?
Well, right now we estimate that a good tree with a good modern system should produce about 15 to 18 gallons of raw sap during the season. It's going to make you somewhere on the order of a quart per tapple on a kind of a below average year, almost to a half gallon of finished maple syrup per tapple. And that's where we try to be, right in that sweet spot.
All right. And let's talk about that ratio, because, boy, 15 to 18 gallons and then translated into about a half a gallon of maple syrup. So it's about 40 to 1?
It is roughly 40 to 1 on an average 2% tree.
Jesse, do you ever think about how did anybody ever figure out that this could be done, given the ratio? I mean, that was a tremendous amount of work to get something this concentrated sweetness.
Yeah, and you know, really what was the tipping point in the entire modern maple syrup world was the end of the Civil War. The boys returned home from the war, and there were some very ingenious inventors out there that began to make the modern maple equipment that we see today. And they went from having cauldrons out in the woods, like my family started with, to flat pans. And from there, they transitioned into flued pans, which increased the surface area. And we now can boil off about, in our system, about 1,200 to 1,600 gallons of water an hour.
Wow.
Into steam. And that all started right after the Civil War. And it really, until the last 5 years, hasn't changed much.
That's amazing. But the tapping technology has changed significantly since then.
It has. You know, we started really early doing a lot of damage to the tree. We would score the side of the tree, put a little stick in there, and collect it into an open wooden bucket on the ground. And then we went to taps. And for, you know, 100 years, we were using 7/16-inch holes in a tree. And now we're drilling 5/16 holes in the tree. Still, those holes will seal over in about a year to a year and a half if the tree is healthy. And we do no real long-term damage to that tree as long as you adhere to the tapping guidelines. And we use maple tubing now. We have about 35 miles of maple tubing strung between tree to tree to tree, to a main line and to a collection tank. That's kind of the modern turnkey system now.
Now, on a much smaller scale, of course, we think about those covered buckets that people can hang in their trees. But I've also seen a big move toward plastic bags.
Yep. Those are cheap. They're about 10 to 15 cents a piece. They'll last you about one season, and they've been designed, unfortunately, as something that you just recycle at the end of the season. You don't have to wash it. Some of the drawbacks with that, you know, deer will chew on them, raccoons will chew on them, squirrels absolutely love them, and as soon as they cut a hole in it, that bag is going to drain out all the sap. So we still use, you know, I go down to the local restaurant, and I have them save me the 5-gallon food-grade pails that some of their food comes in. That's a great alternative. It's a food-grade container. It's a 5-gallon bucket that the squirrels aren't going to eat, and it has a lid to it, so it's sealed from the element.
So, Jesse, do you have a small-scale production in Iowa?
We do. We do. We have one for the university. We have the only portable sugar house in the world right now. It can travel around the state. We will bring sap and we will set it up in the early spring and we will show people how to make maple syrup. So we tap about 100, 150 trees north of Stanhope along the Boone River.
Now, when people do this on their own, very small scale, we've talked about that 40-to-1 ratio, and you've talked about how your family with a larger production manages to evaporate all that water. What are your recommendations for people who want to try to do this at home? Because you don't want to evaporate that much water on your stovetop, right?
You can try that once, and a few things happen quickly. You get the bill for either the gas or the propane, and then all the wallpaper falls off in your house, and your spouse kicks you out. That's how my dad started. And so you really want to do this outside. And most people are going to look and say, I have a turkey burner and a pot. Well, when you think about boiling water, and that's essentially what sap is, it's 98% water, what you quickly realize is you don't have enough surface area. And so you want larger pans with shallower levels of sap in them. And, you know, you can use roasting pans. You can use, if you go down to the local welding shop, they can make you a pan with, you know, 6 or 8 inch sides on it. And you just line it with cinder blocks and start a fire underneath it. So it's a great way to start making maple syrup.
Maybe not long-term sustainable production.
Well, you know, it's called the batch process, and a lot of syrup in Iowa is made that way, and a lot of good syrup is made that way. But it's let's say it's fuel intensive, so you're going to cut a lot of firewood.
Are there other trees that you can tap and also make syrup from their sap?
Oh, absolutely. Well, any maple tree. So even box elders, which are maples, will make maple syrup. But you can tap birch trees and make birch syrup. My cousin taps walnut trees and makes a walnut syrup.
Okay, wait. What does that taste like?
It's hard to describe. It's nothing like, and even birch syrup is nothing like maple syrup. So I would encourage you, if you can find walnut syrup, get yourself a little bottle. You're going to pay a premium for it because most of our walnut, you don't really want to tap a high-grade walnut tree that could be worth thousands of dollars. I can't even describe the taste of it.
Is it good?
It's not bad, let's say. It's just, you know, somebody that has grown up in the syrup industry, when you put something on your pancakes or your waffles, you expect it to taste like syrup or maple syrup,
right.
And it doesn't. So,
but does it taste walnutty?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's actually, it's a unique flavor, and it's not bad.
All right. And how about birch syrup?
Birch syrup is really strong. It's mainly made up in Alaska. We're seeing some get made now in New England. They have quite a few birch trees there. It's very strong, and I can't remember. It was like a wintergreen. I ended up dropping the bottle in my kitchen, and it went all over the floor. So it was a sticky, you know, glass field mess.
Okay, a sticky experiment.
Yeah, and it failed.
All right, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, but we'll find out more about where people can visit the maple syrup production process in your part of Iowa. And I know that there are many places around the state where you can go and see maple syrup being made and, of course, have some pancakes as well. With me, Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I've been talking with Jesse Randall, Iowa State University Extension Forester. And Jesse, before we move on to another topic, so as far as making maple syrup and inviting the public in, are there opportunities coming up?
Absolutely. We're setting up right now some on-farm demonstrations. And so primarily in Northeast Iowa. We're going to work with some of the local larger producers who have the facilities to get us and the public back into the woods to see the tubing systems, to see the buckets, and then we'll tour the sugar house and the modern sugar houses. And so, yeah, they're coming up. If you look at our Forestry Extension website, so if you just Google ISU Forestry Extension, as those dates become available, we're going to put them online and directions of where to go. It'll be a weekend, and we're looking at about from 8 to 4 o'clock, so you can come throughout the day. It won't be, you don't have to stay all day, but we'll be open all day to show you and walk you through the system.
All right. And I know that there are some maple syrup festival opportunities. There's the Maple Syrup Festival at Hartman Reserve Nature Center in Waterloo. That's coming up March 5th and 6th. Greens Sugar Bush has their Pancake Days March 26th and Sunday, April 3rd. And Indian Creek Nature Center has a Maple Syrup Festival as well. So you can look for one in your neck of the woods. I'm sure that there is one nearby. I want to introduce now another forester, two foresters for the price of one today. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm glad I can hear it live today. This is great.
And Jesse got to have all the fun talking about something everybody loves, and you get to talk about the Emerald Ash Borer.
I always get to talk about the bad things, don't I?
All right, but we do have, even though it's not really insect season, we do have new news about the Emerald Ash Borer. What have we learned?
Well, just within the last couple weeks, we announced that in Iowa City, they found Emerald Ash Borer on the University of Iowa campus. Thanks to diligent work by their crew, they were doing some regular pruning and some removing, and they've been through training. They've worked hard at looking for Emerald Ash Borer, and they noticed some things that looked a little concerning. They did some peeling, and they found some larvae. So they visited Mark Vitosh on a Friday afternoon and brought in some branches, and it looked very suspicious. So we referred that to the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, Mike Kenter, who usually comes into these and starts looking for larvae for us. And on Monday of that following week, he found a larva or found a couple larvae, sent those in. Those were verified. So we now have it in Johnson County. Just before the end of the year, Mike actually also found it at a rest area just north of Johnson County in Linn County. So we are up to 30 counties now across the state. And again, just to remind folks, this started in 2010. And so since 2010, when it was first found in Northeast Iowa and Almaquia County, we now have found it in 30 counties. And
it's 30 counties all over the state. It's not really just a concentrated area, right?
Well, if you took the state and you went from the very northeast corner down to the southwest corner, you can actually draw a line. It's pretty much east of that line. So pretty much the northwest and the far west, we haven't found it out there yet. But as we always say, it's probably there. We just haven't found it yet. Because all these times that we have found it, you know, it's usually estimated it's been there a couple years. In some cases, it's been estimated 4 or 5 years. But if you look basically from Hardin County, Hamilton, Webster, out west and northwest of there, it has not been found there yet. So everything is kind of in that southeast quadrant of the state so far. But I have a map with yellow counties on it, and that area is becoming very yellow. So there's not a lot of counties in that southeast corridor that don't have it now.
All right. And we've been through this drill before with the other counties that the Emerald Ash Borer has shown up in, but I'm sure a lot of people don't pay that much attention until it hits their county. Let's say you live in Johnson County. You have an ash tree. What does this mean to you?
Well, we've always talked about if you want to, basically, if you just leave that tree alone, it's going to die at some point. At what point, we can't tell you. Basically, what usually happens, once you find it in an area, the timer starts. And usually within 5 to 10 years, we're going to start seeing some declining in dead trees. A lot of it depends on how big the population was. And within an individual county, depending on the distribution, again, we know it's kind of on the northern tier of Johnson County between Linn and Johnson, and it's down in Iowa City. Well, Johnson's a pretty good-sized county, so We don't know how spread it is. So within the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to start causing death of trees. That's if you don't do anything. If you have individual trees that you really want to protect and they are healthy and they are a good candidate, there are treatments out there. And there's a great publication from Iowa State University that we've talked about many times, Emerald Ash Borer Management Options, PM2084, is out there, and it talks about the different treatments, how often you might have to treat, what can be used. It talks about treatments that are available to homeowners versus treatments that you would have to have done commercially. Now, the one thing we've done in our communities is the DNR, we've actually been very proactive in trying to help communities. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've actually, especially in the eastern part, because we knew the pressure was kind of coming from there, we've worked with communities to inventory, help them inventory or inventory their forest or their tree resources within their public areas. I've actually myself done inventories for North Liberty, Tiffin, Oxford, Solon, and Hills, all in Johnson County. And the university has their own inventory. The University of Iowa knows that they have about 8,000 trees. Only 560 of them, 7%, are ash. So they know exactly what they're dealing with and what they have.
And that seems like a fairly low percentage.
That is a low percent. And they have actively, and a lot of communities are doing it too, they have some great arborists on staff, a guy named Andy Dahl, and he's got a great crew, and they have some great supervisors, and they've been very proactive in the last probably 5 to 10 years. Ever since this started to come up, all they do is plant diversity. They're planting a very diverse species mix within the campus. Probably the last 4 or 5 years, they've actively been managing ash. And so if there are stress trees, trees that are declining, they've got those out. They've put in new trees. They are not going to treat trees on campus. That's going to be their method is trees decline. They actually, within the last couple years, went and kind of really looked at the health of their ash. And they didn't feel that they actually had a candidate for treatment out of 560 trees. They just felt that those trees weren't that healthy. Now, there may be an individual situation here and there because the location of the tree, or maybe it has historical purpose that at some point maybe they think about treating. But they've really looked at diversity. Now, the thing that landowners can also do if they don't treat is they really need to start looking maybe if they've got space to plant something now. They may have another 5 years plus before that tree starts to decline and they have to remove it. They can get something started in a general area close now. So if they do have to remove that tree, they're still getting benefits from it now. They're getting some new stuff started. The trouble that you run into is if you're that person that you have one tree in your yard and that's all you have room for, and right now it's this 42-year-old giant beautiful ash, then if it's a healthy tree, it's got good structure, there are options out there that you could have it treated to help prevent the impact of that. The thing that you have to remember, the average age of ash trees is probably, survival is somewhere between 45 and 70 years. There's always exceptions. So if you have an older tree, you could still treat it, but it could start to decline from other causes. And I have a tree that was planted in 62 in my front yard, and as a forester, I know it's starting to have some issues. I'm not going to treat it. So about 8 years ago, I planted an oak tree close to it that it now is almost 15 feet tall. And so it's going to have a chance if I have to remove that tree in the next 5 to 10 years.
All right. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, Iowa State University Extension Forester Jesse Randall, and also with us, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And they are all here to answer your questions. If you have a tree question, this is your lucky day, but you can call with questions about any of the plants in your life. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start with Don in Woodward. Hi, Don.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for the show today. It's great. I am a tapper. I've been doing it for several years now, and I'm really, really low-tech. What I want to tell folks that are thinking about doing tapping, it's a lot of work. It is serious work. And like I said, mine's real low-tech. I tap about 22 trees. Last year, I got about 150 gallons of sap. This year, I'm going to expand my operation a little bit. I expect to get close to 200 gallons of sap. But it's all going out in the woods and lugging it back by hand. So it's hard work. So I just want folks to understand that it's not an easy.
So what keeps you at it?
Well, I love maple syrup, and I've got relatives and friends all over the continental United States that wait for springtime to get their package from Don.
maple syrup. So now you can't stop.
No, I'm in it for life, unfortunately. I'm 62 now, so eventually I'm going to have to retire, but not yet. What I do is I have a 100-year-old steel cauldron, and literally it's really low tech. I build a fire in my pasture, and I do my batches in 20-gallon batches. So I thought it was interesting to listen to how the commercial growers or the commercial producers do it. Mine for a 20-gallon batch, it takes me about 6 to 7 hours of boiling time. So it's a lot of old firewood. I have scrap wood and junk wood that I use, and I have firewood, so it's all done by hand. But the first 6 hours of it, you just throw the fire on it and just do other stuff. I mean, throw wood in the fire and just let it boil away. Well, when it gets down near the end, then it gets critical. Then you've got to watch it like a hawk, and it goes from this nice, lovely, watery stuff boiling away, it turns to a foam. The minute it turns to a foam, you pull it off the fire. And that's when it's done, and then I can it, and sterilize cans and stuff like that for giving away to gifts, things like that.
All right, and I'll bet the sap is flowing today.
Well, actually, I'm going to tap next week.
Oh, okay, you're going to wait.
What I have found, ambient temperature is nice, but what really, from my experience, is it's not so much been the ambient temperature; it's been the frozen ground. And sometimes we've had these really warm days, and the frost is so deep and so frozen that there is no real flow. So I'm gonna tap next week. So that's my plans.
All right, Don, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Jesse, what do you think? Frozen ground, does that make a difference?
Well, we have all of ours tapped as of yesterday, and I can tell you that we're going to have to gather by the end of the day.
All right. I guess it also depends on exactly where you are and what conditions are like. But you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. They don't have to be about maple syrup, but of course they can be. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Lori. She says, in my visits to farm stores, I've been seeing small electronic-type soil devices that claim to read pH and some even NPK. I don't know what that stands for. Richard, do you know what? Nitrogen, potassium, and
phosphorus.
Yes. Okay, and phosphorus. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. All right. And she says, is this something that has the potential of working or just a way to spend money? If they have potential, what features would you look for?
I would basically do it at a soil testing lab if I was going to do it, because they have very accurate machinery, and they can do it correctly. Some of those instruments give you kind of a ballpark figure, and they're not very accurate.
Okay. So just a way to spend money, perhaps?
Perhaps, yes.
Okay. Here's a question from Angela. I have an amaryllis that has bloomed and is finished blooming. Any suggestions for what to do with the bulb? Can I store it in some way to try to let it bloom again next year, or just say goodbye?
Well, saying goodbye is one option, putting it in the compost pile. The other option is it only blooms once a year. So you have to give it good care the rest of the year for it to bloom again next winter. And so you would put it in a sunny window. Treat it like a house plant. Water the plant when the soil surface becomes dry to the touch. Fertilize maybe once or twice a month using a dilute fertilizer solution. And then I would bring it outside probably sometime toward late May. And initially harden it outside where you put it in the shade for a few days. Gradually expose it to some sunlight. And then after maybe a week or 10 days, then dig a hole, set the pot in the ground, put it in partial sun, morning sun, afternoon shade. Keep on watering if it's dry, if we don't have any rain. Keep on fertilizing through the summer, and then bring it inside basically around mid-September. And when you bring it inside in mid-September, place it in a room that's on the dark side, fairly cool, and don't water. Stop watering completely, and you'll force it to go dormant, where the leaves basically turn brown and die, at which point you can cut it off, those dead leaves, and then the actual bulb needs to rest for 8 to 10 weeks. and the temperature needs to be around 50 to 55. Those temperatures initiate flower development in the bulb, and so they need that. And then after those 8 to 10 weeks, you move it to a warmer area, start to water, and you wait.
All right. And you can also choose to say goodbye.
Yes, you can.
And after listening to that, well, it's a valid option. All right, let's go to the phones. Jamie's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about treating ash trees. My understanding is that what you're doing basically is poisoning that tree for any normal insects that might be on that tree. I just wonder, what effect does the treatment have on normal insects that might be on the tree and on any birds that might eat those insects?
All right. Thanks for the question, Jamie. And I know this is a concern a lot of people share.
Yeah. There's actually some good information out there, Jamie. If you go to the National Emerald Ash Borer site, there's good research out of Michigan State, Ohio State, Purdue, and others. They've looked at this. So far, they have not seen any indications with bird species eating larvae and stuff. The one thing to remember is this particular chemical, in most cases, it depends on which chemical is used, Jamie. There is one chemical that if basically that gets up in the plant, that will kill most insects. And that's the one that homeowners often use. That chemical will kill a lot. The one thing to think about with pollinators and stuff like that, so far, the flowering and stuff of ash is not used by a lot of different pollinators, and the timing, they don't see issues there. The one homeowner chemical that it is used, if that's used near flowering plants, it's used as a soil drench. There's actually some stuff on the label. You don't want to use it near lindens, near flowering plants, because if it gets into the flower, that can cause an impact. Most of the other chemicals, though, are specific to larvae that are actually feeding underneath the bark, and it's attacking them separately. But the research is still out there and looking close at that.
All right, Jamie, thanks for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions in a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension forester Jesse Randall, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, we've got Roger on the line in Bancroft. Hi, Roger.
Yes, good morning. So I have a multi-species windbreak of hazelnut and aronia berry. And boy, the rabbits have just really gone at the stems. And so I'm curious if they're just eating the bark or if they're getting all the way through the cambium. And can I check that in some way to see whether I should prune those out or not? I love the windbreak. It's doing its job today, that's for sure.
I guess I'll be the bearer of bad news. In a lot of cases, the rabbit damage we see has gone all the way through that outer vascular structure and disrupted enough that you're probably going to have to remove those. There might be enough nutrient and moisture in the remaining stem above that to have it flush, but then those leaves will wilt. So I think you'll be better off this time of year, early spring, taking out the material that's been damaged and allowing those plants to resprout from the collar. That's going to save you a lot of heartache down the road.
Great. Thanks.
All right, Roger, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number for you to call with your questions. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Earlier, we were talking about how there are going to be a lot of maple syrup festivals and opportunities for people to get a glimpse of the maple syrup making process around the state. And our good friend Joe McNally from the Iowa Arboretum sent us one from Madrid. He says they're hosting a maple syrup day on April 9th. So you'll get an opportunity to taste maple syrup and learn about the process. And like I said, there are opportunities like this all over the state. So look for one near you. Here's a question from Lolly. Would it be ideal to attempt to bring part of the hill in my backyard, which slopes toward the house, into prairie or natural landscape? If so, what is the best method and where do I get seeds for this?
Okay, that would be an option if it's in full sun. And there are various mixes available from various companies. The key there would be that you need to destroy the existing vegetation, and you can do that with Roundup. And then you can seed basically directly into that dead debris. So that would be an option. Now, if you do that, it doesn't look like much the first year or two. You see a lot of weeds, but be patient. And if you've done a good job, you'll have a nice kind of prairie in about 3 to 4 years.
All right.
There's some good literature out there, actually, from Iowa State University on different plants, depending on your soil types, mm-hmm. as far as different things you want to do. Because another management thing, if that hill is not too steep, is to mow it, especially early on the first year, to actually keep the weed plants from getting to seed. So you actually mow that the first couple months of the summer to basically keep it short. And then as basically the summer goes, you try to raise that mowing. So if it's a hill, she might have to use a weed whacker or something like that to mow it. But that helps keeps those weeds from going to seed. And basically those perennial plants that you're trying to establish are building up their root system that first year. And then usually after that, you can kind of let it go. But as Richard said, often be prepared for it to look ugly and for the first couple years. And often at that 2 to 3 year period, they blossom. The other recommendation I would make is that they maybe contact their local soil and water conservation district, depending on which county or NRCS. They often have nice information on establishing prairie, or they can often give you a list of local seed sources, especially if you want that local genotype in that local area. If there's sources close by, they can get those for you.
All right. And during the ugly stage, you might, if you live in town, want to have a statement prepared for your neighbors as well.
Check your nuisance or weed rule, because they may require you to mow it.
All right. Yes. Be ready.
Yes.
All right. Here's a question from Sam in West Des Moines. I have a 2-year-old asparagus bed. Last summer, almost all of the tops died in August and September. Close investigation showed asparagus beetles and also some form of purple blight. I've removed all the tops and cleaned the bed to get rid of all the infected tops. What can I expect this spring with this bed? And is there anything I can do between now and then? Or is it toast?
You're making a lot of noise, Richard.
Right. Those sounded like the toast noises.
It didn't sound good.
Now, it's hard to say. I'm not really concerned about the beetles. They can damage the actual foliage, but they're not going to cause a great deal of harm to the plants themselves. Now, if they died back late last summer, I'm concerned they may have some type of root rot. And if they have, then they may not come back. And we did have a very wet year last year. They do not like wet sites. So possibly they got a root rot, and they may not come back very well this year. So if they don't, I would look for an alternate site. If they do come back, kind of thin, not very vigorous, then I would be inclined not to harvest this year and let the plants try to regain their vigor for next year.
And if he needs to find an alternate site, does it have to be a certain distance away from this site to prevent the problem from reoccurring?
Not really. It just has to be a well-drained soil and full sun. If they have those two things, they're all right, but avoid low spots in the landscape.
All right. Here's a comment and question from Jeff. I've just read a study confirming that fringe tree is also a host for emerald ash borer. Could your guest please talk about whether or not this is true and give me some insight for the landscaping plant nursery community regarding the ethical practice of selling or planting those trees?
Well, I'll start, and Jesse, you can jump in here. It is true. It was actually found in Ohio, I believe, last year, the year before, where the insect actually completed its life cycle within that species.
Now, does that mean they've run out of ash trees there?
Not necessarily. But I think it was in an area where there was a pretty heavy infestation. The thing that folks have to remember about this is when it was first found in 2002 in the Michigan area, the research paper was one page long. That was all the research that was done on emerald ash borer. So they've done a lot of research, and they continue, and this kind of goes back to the earlier caller about the impacts on insects and health, or good insects and bad insects as far as treatments. There's a lot of work that's being done, so the research is still continuing, and every year we're getting more results on all these different facets. So before this happened, they basically thought it was just going to be on ash. Their early research, they actually had certain plants that they tried to get the insect to complete its life cycle. They weren't having success. But somebody found this one, and they've done some looking, and it's so they're going to do more research on it. So the one thing for Iowa, and maybe Richard knows too, that plant doesn't get planted a lot here. It's not native here, so I don't think it's going to be as a big issue. But I think we'll hear, if we're going to see more of this on other plants, it'll be as time happens, especially in Michigan and areas where the populations have been high. We'll see those impacts, but it is true.
All right. Here's a question from Christine. She says, we live in Iowa City and have an ash tree on the parkway between the sidewalk and the street. I believe that means the city owns it. Am I right about that? So will the city handle this tree when it needs to come down? And how can I tell if it's becoming a danger?
Yes, yes, and yes. The city will handle it if it's within the right-of-way. Every community is different. People need, now in the city of Iowa City, they do have a forestry department that does handle that. They do the pruning. They'll do the removing. In most communities, by state law, they are required to handle trees within the right-of-way when it comes to disease and insect for removal. But in some communities, based on their ordinance, they require the adjacent citizen to prune over the sidewalk, over the street. So they need to, depending on where they live, wherever you are in the state of Iowa, you need to check with your local ordinances. But usually for removal and that, they will handle that. I guess the thing that I would, as with anything, we always talk about the symptoms of emerald ash borer. It tends to start at the top, and usually you'll see some declining, some dead branches, some thinning. The other thing to look for is what we call bird flecking, is up in the crown of the tree. If the insect is there, there's a number of woodpecker species that will start to look for that insect, and they'll actually fleck off the bark. And when you fleck off ash bark, it's kind of a grayish brown. And when you fleck it off, you get kind of a white look. And this time of year is a great time to go look at the top of your tree to see if you're starting to see that color. If you're seeing that flecking, that means the woodpeckers are trying to figure it out. They're looking. But it doesn't mean that they found the thing. Then you get your binoculars out, and you look at those flecks to see if they're pecking. If they're pecking, they're actually making holes, and they think they're maybe going to find something. They basically can hear them, or they feel the vibration of the feeding, and they go after them. If you see that, then you may want to contact the city and say, I think I may have a suspect tree. The other thing that we see coordinated to that is the dieback. And then often, if that tree really has it, you'll get a lot of sprouting, either coming from the trunk or up through the top. So this summer, you'll see all this new green foliage coming through the top, and maybe the top is thinning. Those are all potential symptoms of the emerald ash borer. The other thing I guess I would look at is if there's something structurally weakened, like that tree has broken stems or cracks in it, and it's a concern, then I would contact. But if the tree's growing healthy and the crown looks good, I would wait till it starts to have problems. And they'll be doing inventories. The city of Iowa City actually has a plan in place that hopefully starting this year, they're going to try to inventory all their community trees to see how many ash they actually have.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Dennis is on the line in Eldridge. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have pin oaks in my yard, anywhere from 20 to 24 inches in diameter. They're probably 60 foot tall. I had one that was maybe a foot in diameter. The last couple of years, the first year, it lost some of its leaves. The next year, it lost all of its leaves early in the fall. And usually, they hold the leaves over the winter. And the next year, it died, or it was dead. I was wondering what might cause this and what I can do to stop it.
Do you want to start, Jesse, and I'll chime in?
Well, first thing we have to figure out is really what killed it. And you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I hear a member of the red oak family loses its leaves in the growing season and then doesn't, you know, flush out the next year, the first thing I think of is oak wilt. And has there been any pruning during that, during the active growing season over the last few years?
Very little.
Okay. But,
very little.
But some?
I clipped some of the lower hanging branches that was head high.
Okay.
And they was only maybe the size of your little finger.
Okay. Did you do it during the growing season, though, Dennis?
Okay.
Did you do it during the growing season?
Okay.
No,
that's did I do it?
Yeah, when did you do it?
Did you prune during the growing season?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes.
So normally when it comes to our oaks, we're very careful during the growing season to make any open wound on those trees. And what happens is an insect vector, the little picnic beetle, can carry the oak wilt spores and land on that wound and transmit oak wilt. And that's the primary mode during the growing season when you have an open wound, how that disease gets in there and can spread rapidly, and it destroys the vascular structure of that tree. And the tree literally dries itself out from the inside out. It can't get moisture from the roots up to the leaves, and those leaves keep photosynthesizing, and they dry themselves out.
But, okay. But usually, Mark? Dennis, the symptoms that you would see for oak wilt, like on a pin oak or a red oak, is during the growing season, usually like July or August, you'll think it's fall. You'll start to see leaves just start falling off the tree fairly rapidly. And with red oaks, usually they die in one season. But I've seen on pin oaks and some red oaks, sometimes that can take one or two seasons. But you would see this rapid kind of leaf drop. And if it's warm, usually sometimes those leaves are even green when they kind of fall off. So if you're not seeing that, you could have something else going on. You could have girdling roots at the base of the tree that's causing some stress. The other question I would ask you is the color of that particular tree. Was it showing some yellowing or anything like that? Because you could have also had some severe chlorosis, which is related to the pH. The one thing I would suggest is if some of your other trees start to show symptoms, is to get some pictures of those, take them to your county extension office, and then they can send them to the folks in Ames at the diagnostic clinic or whatever, and they can start to see what the correlation is and maybe try, as Jesse said, actually diagnose what's causing the problem.
All right. Well, Dennis, good luck with that. And let's
on that
talk
topic.
Right on that subject. This is the moment to take care of your oak trees, right?
Yes. I'm actually, if you want to learn how to prune your trees, actually tomorrow, February 20th, tomorrow, I'm going to be in Grinnell at Aaron's Family Center working with the city from 10 to noon, and we're going to do a demonstration on pruning shade trees, which one of the topics will be is when should I prune my oaks? And what we normally say is basically starting in November or when we get a couple good hard frosts till about the 1st of March, depending on the weather. So this next 2 weeks, if you want to prune your oaks still, would be a great time over these next 2 weeks to get out there and get that done.
All right. And do it now because
yes.
You don't want to do it later.
Don't
you can
call when I'm on the show in the middle of April and say, should I prune my oaks? Because we'll say no.
All right.
In a nice way.
Right. Well, and here's one more question about timeliness that we can sneak in here before the end of the hour. This is from Jay in Norwalk. Is it too early to remove the mulch from my strawberry beds?
Absolutely. You want to wait till about mid-April. You want to discourage them as long as you can, because if you take it off early, we have some warm weather and they bloom early, and then we have a late frost or freeze, you lose all the flowers. So leave it on.
All right. We get so excited on
yes,
these
we do.
Warm days. Don't do it. Prune right. Your oak trees. Don't remove your mulch. All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Jesse Randall, thank you.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension forester Jesse Randall and Mark Vitosh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. It's been Horticulture Friday. We have next Friday off, and then the next week we come back to weekly Horticulture Day. And if that's not a sure sign of spring, then I don't know one. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon. Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.